Welcome to The Environment Show, exploring issues and events of the planet. I'm Thomas Lally. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby from Bennington, Vermont. 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is former Environmental Conservation Commissioner for the state of New York and former president of the National Audubon Society, Peter Burley.
Thanks, Thomas. Coming up on this week's Environment Show, the government protects us from cancer-causing chemicals, but they don't protect us from chemical doses that affect our reproductive system. Can electric cars improve our environment? A world record was set when a vehicle recently drove 375 miles on a single charge. We'll tell you about the event. Our Ear to the Ground looks at a group fighting to keep pesticides off your dinner plate. And our Earth Calendar visits an orgy on Cape May on the Delaware Bay, where mating horseshoe crabs are 3 feet deep on the beach and migrating songbirds are having a feeding frenzy on their eggs. These stories and more coming up this week on The Environment Show. Previously, we looked at chemicals called endocrine disruptors, which include DDT, PCBs, and dioxin. The debate was about their effect on sperm count and the reproductive systems of humans and animals. As part of our continuing series, we now consider the adequacy of tests used by the government to determine if chemicals that act like or affect hormones are safe.
The regulatory structure today is focused primarily around the prevention of cancer, and while it's extremely important that we do that, what we've learned through the process of exploring this issue is that protecting against cancer misses a whole series of threats. And the reason why the basic reason why that takes place is because the effects that we're talking about here occur at dosages of exposure that are significantly below what it takes to cause cancer. So that to be able to protect the public from risks created by hormone disruption, we're going to have to raise the standards. We're going to have to be more protective than what protecting against cancer would dictate.
J.P. Myers is the co-author of the recent book, Our Stolen Future. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency recently announced that it is revising their chemical testing guidelines. The guidelines and the proposed revisions have come under increasing criticism from scientists who say that cancer orientation means the effect of endocrine disruptors on humans and wildlife is overlooked. Fred Vimsall, a professor of biology at the University of Missouri, is a lead researcher on the effects of low doses of hormones. He says the proposed and existing testing methods miss the mark.
We're interested in how very low doses, the amount of chemicals that are in our body, we refer to these as environmentally relevant doses, how they alter fetal development. The major emphasis with regard to endocrine disruptors is the effects that they have on fetuses. And the focus of my research has been on something that has not been done previously, and we're concerned because it is also not included in the current EPA guidelines for testing endocrine disruptors, the health effects test guidelines that have just been put out by the EPA. And what we are finding is that at very low doses of environmental chemicals that serve as that act as endocrine disruptors, you get opposite effects from what you get at very high doses. And yet the testing guidelines only propose to test effects of these chemicals at very high doses. The traditional approach has been more of a chemical will give you a more of a response, a greater response. And yet hormones don't do that. After they've occupied all of the available receptor sites in a responsive cell, what happens is, as you add more hormone, you begin decreasing the response capability of the cell. It's called a down-regulating event until you can get no response or at very high doses, and exact opposite response than you get at low doses. Let me give you an example. Many years ago, physicians treated breast cancer by giving very high levels of estrogen. And what the very high levels of estrogen would do would be inhibit breast development. And if that's the only information that had ever been available about estrogen, the conclusion about estrogen would be that it's a great inhibitor of the breast. But at millions of times lower, the amounts that are actually present in a woman's body, lo and behold, it's the most potent stimulator of breast development and growth. So one of the problems we're faced with is, since environmental chemicals that act like hormones, and there are many of them out there that act like the molecule estrogen that's present in women's bodies and in men's bodies as well, lo and behold, these chemicals have only been tested at very high levels. And my research suggests that we might expect to see the exact same type of opposite effects at very high doses relative to what you might expect at low doses. And what we're proposing is the only way to know what the amounts of chemicals that are in our bodies are actually doing is to monitor people for the amounts of these chemicals in their bodies and then set up a test that uses that information as the basis for dosing in animal studies. And that has never been done, and it is not being proposed as a testing strategy in the current health effects test guidelines.
Vamsal says we really don't know about the low-dose effect of chemicals already in our bodies through environmental contamination.
The only thing that has ever been done is to use very, very high, in millions of times higher. I'm not talking about a little bit higher. I'm talking about millions of times higher levels of chemicals in animal studies than people are being exposed to. And then they're saying, based on this high-dose study, we can tell you what will happen at a low dose. And we absolutely know with regard to hormones, that is false. You cannot do that. My studies clearly show that.
Well, that would indicate that the whole low-dose spectrum of consequences is something that we're flying absolutely blind on. Is that overstating the case?
That is absolutely accurate. We know nothing about low-dose effects. They have never been examined. Never.
EPA's testing criteria take on particular significance because industry representatives say that the burden is on the government to deal with the thousands of chemicals already in the marketplace. John McCarthy is the Vice President for Scientific and Regulatory Affairs for the American Crop Protection Association, which is the trade association for the basic producers and formulators of pesticides that are used in agriculture.
The EPA has the responsibility to make those calls, really, when all is said and done. They have information, and if they need more information, they should require it of companies who produce these products and make those assessments and take whatever action is necessary, if indeed action is necessary. So there's such a whole variety of things in which we're exposed to that to kind of paint with a big broad brush is, I don't think, proper. I think we're still on a substance-by-substance evaluation, and EPA should and they are focusing on this very question.
Dealing with chemicals in the environment that disrupt the endocrine system and reproductive functions is a major challenge. There's real concern about whether EPA's existing and proposed testing guidelines are asking the appropriate questions to protect humans and wildlife still in the womb. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, can electric cars help the environment? A world record was recently set when an electric car drove 375 miles on a single charge. Meet some folks on the ear to the ground who want to keep pesticides out of the food chain. And our Earth calendar will explore why shorebirds are dependent on the annual landing of horseshoe crabs on the mid-Atlantic coast. These stories still ahead on The Environment Show. Electric vehicles promise to significantly cut down air pollution and our reliance on fossil fuels. But while they've made great strides in recent years, they remain out of the American mainstream. Auto manufacturers say it may well be after the year 2000 before this technology will compete with gas-burning cars. But others say the future is here. This year, a car in the Tour de Sol electric car race set a world record by going 375 miles in a single charge. Environment Show producer Thomas Lally reports.
Along the East River, near the bottom of Manhattan, about 40 cars attract the attention of thousands of passers-by. Most of the cars look nothing out of the ordinary, but these cars represent the latest in technology which is hoped to reduce pollution and our reliance on fossil fuels. The need for these vehicles is great. In many areas, emissions from cars and trucks account for over half of most of the pollutants in the air. The pollution contributes to global warming, acid rain, and a host of other environmental and health problems. Switching to less polluting technology like electric vehicles would significantly reduce these emissions. Tom Thompson is the executive director of the Northeast Sustainable Energy Association, the group sponsoring today's event.
The importance of this race is that it demonstrates the practical use of electric vehicles and the opportunity to recharge those batteries with renewably generated electricity.
There are all kinds of electric, hybrid, and natural gas cars here. Some were built by top scientists, others were made in high school shop classes. Major auto manufacturers like Toyota, Ford, and Chrysler are also here. They represent the real money and power in this debate. While Toyota plans to begin selling a Jeep-like electric car this fall, American companies say their technology isn't ready for the market. Ken Mack is with the Chrysler Corporation. Their cars are sleek and sporty. They'd be fancy even if they ran on gasoline. But Mack says there's one problem. The cars can't go very far.
Well, there's some good news, there's some bad news. As I mentioned before, batteries aren't here yet. But we have made a van that drives like a regular gasoline van. Except the range is very short, 60 miles on a good day. When you put the heater and AC on, then you lose considerable.
But a lot of people here question that. Carl Feidman is with Solectria Corporation. One of their cars set the world record in the race by running 374 miles on a single charge. That sort of range is much more than enough to satisfy the average commuter. But the technology is still expensive.
Basically, a pack of batteries for this car today runs about $30,000, which is about half the price of what they were last year. So we see that as being positive, that there has been a substantial reduction. We also see that price coming way down. Right now, these batteries are being handmade by PhD chemists on a lab bench, so of course they're expensive. In large volume production, the price could come down to the point where it rivals lead acid, particularly given its long lifespan.
But electric cars can also be built by teenagers. Nigel Todd is from Ottawa Hills High School in Michigan. He's part of a class that worked on an electric car for the past 2 years.
One day, gasoline won't be there. So I think that by building this car, it shows people that it can be done, because people nowadays are not listening to what people have to say as far as like people like GM. You know, they wanted to produce a solar car or electric car, and they said it was impossible. So, you know, people like us, we're showing them that it is possible to do.
The big problem with electric cars is the battery. Gasoline-powered cars have internal combustion engines, which constantly burn energy. Very little power needs to be stored. But electric cars rely nearly 100% on batteries. Today, the cheapest and most widely used battery is a lead-acid battery. But they won't cut it for most Americans, since they only last about 60 miles on a single charge, and their lead poses a disposal problem. Catherine is with a company called Wallingford AC, which currently sells electric cars here and in Canada.
This is a Skoda, and it's an electric vehicle. It's not a retrofit. We've got the cars are coming from Czechoslovakia, and it has a range of 70 miles, and it'll go 50 miles an hour. We're selling this one, in fact, right here, and we have two other pickups that we're selling today.
So if a company from Eastern Europe can make an electric car, why can't the American car companies do the same? Ken Mack from Chrysler says they're working on it. But the American market demands that electric cars perform the same or better than their gas-powered counterparts. But many environmentalists are skeptical. They say the American car companies are just dragging their heels, the same way they resisted seatbelts, airbags, and unleaded gasoline. Sheila Lynch is the executive director of the Northeast Alternative Vehicle Coalition. She says Chrysler should stop whining.
Chrysler is being schizophrenic. They're both denying it can happen, but working very hard on it, and they have teams of engineers working on it. And I would say that all the major seven auto manufacturers have very large electric vehicle programs underway right now. They're not going to miss out on this.
Besides electric vehicles, this year's race included hybrids, which run on a combination of power sources. Some combine electric and gasoline power, doubling fuel efficiency. Other cars use fuels like propane and natural gas. The technology is still new and expensive, but organizers hope the need for a Tour de Sol will one day end when electric and other less polluting cars will be the norm. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
You're listening to The Environment Show. Reach us by email at envshow@aol.com. That's envshow@aol.com. You can hear any of our last four shows via the Internet. Go to our webpage, www.wamc.org/env, and click on Listen to the Environment Show. That's www.wamc.org/env.
I'm Linda Anderson, and this is Ear to the Ground, with stories about people affecting change in the environment. This week, pesticides for dinner. Just how safe is the food we eat and the water we drink? That's a question that Food and Water Incorporated, a national grassroots organization concerned about the safety of food, has been asking for the past 10 years. Based in Walden, Vermont, Food and Water has been working with food-related issues such as food irradiation, pesticides, and food biotechnology. These concerns, they believe, reach far beyond the kitchen table, having effect on our environment, community, human rights, animal welfare, and democracy. They are a skeptical bunch who point their collective finger at big business. Michael Colby is director of Food and Water. He says the organization thrives on information and activism. Food and Water, he explains, gets work done not by begging Congress, not by fighting for regulatory reform or congressional laws, but by directing activism towards what he believes to be the true source of power, food corporations and supermarkets. As consumers of food products, he says, people give them enormous amounts of money. Collectively, he believes, we can have an enormous impact when we tell them our concerns about how food is purchased, grown, and processed. Food and Water has thousands of people around the country that are ready to take action.
We're able to generate quite an extensive response from the public directed directly to these companies. Usually when we call for an action, we get thousands of phone calls and sometimes tens of thousands of letters, which really has a major impact. That's how we're able to secure statements from some of the largest food corporations in the country, because we're able to galvanize such grassroots citizen support on our issues.
For example, their recent push to prevent FDA approval for the irradiation of beef.
We targeted one of the top, in fact, the top beef company in the nation, which is called IBP. They control about 50 to 60% of the beef supply in this country. A huge corporation. Within about 2 or 3 weeks of targeting them, we got a statement from the company saying that they had no intentions of irradiating their beef. They agreed with our concerns and wanted to assure their customers that even if the government approves it, they're not going to use it.
Colby says this is an incredible victory for food safety. Their goal, he says, will be to move on to the next largest beef company in the hopes of creating a domino effect. For the last year and a half, Food and Water has been organizing a campaign focusing on 71 known carcinogenic pesticides in our food supply. These pesticides are currently approved under what Colby believes is a faulty program called negligible risk.
Or acceptable risk, as it's sometimes called, is where the government, usually the EPA, weighs the health consequences of these carcinogenic pesticides, which is cancer, versus the economic benefits to the food companies that use them.
Colby says that Food and Water doesn't think there is anything acceptable about a risk that they feel could be avoided. He says it's another instance of putting profits before the health and well-being of people. With Ear to the Ground, this is Linda Anderson.
And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. In Delaware and New Jersey, on the shores of Delaware Bay, the largest concentration of horseshoe crabs anywhere in the world assembles at this time of year to lay their eggs. Sometimes in Cape May, the crabs will stack up six deep on the beach. This phenomenon occurs annually from mid-May through June, and according to Joan Walsh, biologist and research coordinator for the New Jersey Audubon Society, the crabs look like flattened conquistador helmets bulldozing through the sand.
When the female is ready to lay her eggs, she comes up onto the shore, and frequently she'll already have a male clasped to her back. Sometimes the males will be clasped onto the females for as long as 6 months during the winter before the spring. The female, with the male clasped to her back, comes up at the high tide, crawls up to somewhere slightly below the high tide line, and digs a hole and begins to deposit her eggs. When she's doing this, she attracts what are called satellite males to come in, and they gather around the egg mass that she's laying, and they also will try and fertilize the eggs.
The horseshoe crab spring ritual provides a key link in the annual northward migration of shorebirds. Sandpipers, red knots, and turnstones arrive as the crabs come ashore, descending to feast on the crab eggs. The birds dive and shriek and strut up and down the beach and peck at one another in a frenzy.
Several species of shorebirds, which have been wintering in South America, are flying north to their breeding grounds in the Arctic, and they stop along the way. They arrive on the shores of New Jersey and Delaware with most of their energy reserves depleted. Some of them have flown all the way from Argentina to New Jersey in one flight, and they refuel using these shorebird eggs. So you end up with this mass spectacle of hundreds of thousands of horseshoe crabs laying their eggs and hundreds of thousands of shorebirds eating the horseshoe crab eggs. It's a spectacle is about the only way to describe it.
Horseshoe crabs serve multiple human uses as well. For one, the crab's royal blue blood contains a chemical called lysate, which is used to test all intravenous drugs in the United States for dangerous bacteria. According to Walsh, the extraction of their blood is a harmless procedure, and the crabs are later released. The crabs are also used as a bait source for the eel industry, and eels are used for fish bait as well as human consumption. Increased harvesting, however, has caused concern because there's been a significant decline in crab numbers over the years, and Walsh wonders whether over-harvesting is taking a toll on their population.
The harvest was unrestricted until a few years ago in the state of New Jersey when the state passed some regulations to protect the shorebirds. And we felt that it was probably time to have some stricter controls on the number that were taken until we had a good understanding of what exactly is happening to this population of crabs. Because, A, they're important. It's important to maintain this population. It's the world's most dense population of horseshoe crabs. For the crab's sake, it's important to maintain the population, and then it's important to maintain it to help the shorebirds. It's also important to maintain it so that the traditional fishery can continue.
The sight of blocks of some of the world's oldest and most primitive creatures bulldozing their way through the beaches of Delaware Bay is unforgettable. If you're a shorebird watcher in Argentina, the piling-strewn beach of Cape May, New Jersey, does not sound very appealing. But it may be more important to you than the beautiful swimming spots closer to home. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-323-9262 and ask for program number 335. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Thomas Lally is the producer, Stephanie Goichman provided additional production support, and Dr. Alan Shartok is the executive producer. The Environment Show is made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby. 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long, and join us next week for The Environment Show.